Helm, set a course.
Hit him.
Engage.
Let's fly.
Welcome, one and all, to Discovery, a Star Trek podcast by Fantastic Geek, your official, unofficial Star Trek podcast. My name is Matt, and joining me, as always, is Pete. Hailing frequencies are open.
Fail to prepare, prepare to fail, son. Discovery, a Star Trek podcast by Fantastic Geek for episode 504, Face the Strange, comes to you now via a bag.
Pete, going from Star Trek to Star Wars ever so briefly, looking forward to podcasting and viewing the Acolyte series on Disney Plus, landing in about 6 weeks' time. Certainly excited for that whole forthcoming space-based adventure.
Yes, this week in an interview, star Amanda Stenberg referred to the show as a prequel to the prequels. And Matt, what do you know? Star Wars Episode One, The Phantom Menace, the prequel, comes to theaters again, returns on May the 3rd.
I mean, great minds think alike. I'm thinking how Strange New Worlds is a prequel to a prequel. So lots of space-based prequeling here. Pete, moving from Star Wars to Marvel, you might recall there was that really lousy one movie that was out in between Shang-Chi and in between that and the Spider-Man that everybody loves. Are we going to see more Kit Harington as guy who's in that movie?
On the heels of his Game of Thrones follow-up series falling apart in development that they were totally excited about. They're not excited anymore. It's like that old Kevin Nealon skit on Saturday Night Live. Now questioning whether he will return to the MCU, this after Matt's favorite MCU offering that he likes to play down, the Eternals. We've not heard about Blade in a while. It was believed he's in the Blade cast. Just have to see, Matt. Not a lot going on with Marvel this week. No Deadpool and Wolverine news. So got to get the tongues wagging somehow, I guess.
Yeah, I think, Pete, with, you know, Wolverine on the screen this July and Fantastic Four and potentially more X-Men, all that is going to solve the MCU. I don't know that we're turning back to Eternals anytime soon. But Pete, bringing it back to Star Trek, sad news in the last couple days. Just uber fan John G. Trimble has passed away. And, you know, there was Star Trek past the three seasons because of John Trimble, his wife Bijo Trimble, really leading the forefront of that fandom into the 1970s and taking us where we are today.
There is no Star Trek now without the contributions of John G. Trimble. So really sad to hear that happened, but he and his wife kept Star Trek alive at a time when, you know, we talk all the time, chaos on the bridge, right? But they truly navigated it through perhaps the most important time, ultimately bringing it back.
Well, Pete, talking about Star Trek's future, Paramount's future, quick update. In the last week, there's been, I'd say, more than rumblings that Sony and venture capital firm Apollo may join up and make a play for Paramount. This makes a ton of sense. I think in my, you know, with my poor business acumen, it makes a ton of sense. I think it could pass regulators and things of that sort. But the question for Star Trek is, does Sony get a streamer that it does not have in Paramount Plus, or does Sony continue its role as an arms dealer selling content to everybody? Because, you know, what's the jewel? What's one of the jewels in the crown? It is, of course, Star Trek. So who gets the Star Trek baby is tied up in this latest play here for the future of Paramount.
I just want this over, and I want someone to fix where I watch these TV shows because I couldn't even cycle back and forth from season 5 to season 2 to a short trek to check something for this podcast without closing the app multiple times.
Pete, I know we're not the only ones feeling frustrated with Paramount Plus as an app, and perhaps in part to soothe what ails ye, dear listener, we have in the future, a little bit later in the podcast, we're going to talk about some goodies, some things that can turn frowns upside down, and so forth. But I think right now, Pete, let's head into the mission briefing.
15 hours ago, Maul and Locke are asked if they got the Latinum as they make a transaction on the surface of a planet. Locke hands the seller the bag. What is this? Amateur hour? You're supposed to stack the Latinum, you know, for TV. And so it's easier to count. But it was all they could do last minute. As their seller takes out of the bag, he tells them it'll only cover the original cost as the price has gone up. He starts to cough, and Maul tells him they heard he'd try to do this, so they soak the Latinum in Fabiano poison, you know, the kind he sold to the Emerald Chain to use on people like her. As he foams and falls, she takes the item they were buying off his still writhing person, and Locke asks, what if it doesn't work? But Maul is confident it will, and they'll move ahead of Discovery for the clues to the progenitor's tech. Locke feels like the walls are closing in on them as their seller grabs his calf. But Maul tells him they'll be successful and shake the bounties on their heads once and for all. As their seller kicks, they kiss, and it's time to go because Discovery won't be at Trill much longer.
Pete, I enjoyed the dark humor here of the buyer continuing to writhe as he, you know, slowly is poisoned to death. I am somewhat reminded, though, of another space story, and I'm being completely serious here. The whole, you know, who shot first, Han versus Greedo type thing. I don't think anybody was turned off to the character of Han Solo if indeed he did shoot first, because, you know, it was clear it was proactive self-defense, blah, blah, blah. But here's my point, Pete.
Here's my point.
This scene ending with, we shall be free, we shall kiss, we are anti-heroes, not baddies, we are paying back the poisoning, what was done to us. That's all kind of evocative in this, you know, kind of Wild West space frontier and all of that. To have the guy writhing as he slowly dies does undercut that a bit. It strengthens Maul and Locke as baddies in a scene that I think is meant to strengthen them as people, Pete, that at the end of the season, I think we could say, and Locke is now more comfortable back with his people or the shapeshifters or whatever, and Maul does want to become a cadet. It's just a curious choice, that's all.
Today on Discovery, the item they bought that Maul placed on Adira's uniform activates as Adira speaks to Gray via subspace. The unseen Gray is really happy they can remain friends and hopes they can see each other again in a few months when Gray graduates to the next level of his guardian training. The spider-like device crawls through the cabin as Adira looks at a holo photo with Gray, and they turn when they hear something. But Stamets calls in and asks Adira to go adjust the deuterium manifold on Deck 9. As Adira leaves their quarters, the bug urges into the wall.
Meanwhile, on the bridge, the ship has arrived at the spot for which they were headed, but it's a big zero all around. Reese does say maybe Disco is leading Maul and Locke in some sort of, you know, like they've been bugged somehow and they just don't know it. Commander Raynor shoots it down quickly, even as we see the bug hiding on the bridge. Burnham pulls Raynor into the ready room for a conference. Pete, it's the 32nd century. They don't walk, they beam in. It's also important to the plot. He sees the crew as too comfortable and talky given the gravity of the situation. It's a red directive, Pete. He's reminded that, you know, the crew of Discovery kind of has saved the universe multiple times. They got this. And he tells Burnham to spare the I get you baloney. Ultimately, though, okay, him saying the other word for baloney, Pete, it was a little over the line. She notes that he needs to toe the line. However, they do ponder, what if his way is better? Pete, I hope we get some sort of Star Trek compromise by the end of the episode where they're both right.
In engineering, Stamets stops his work for a second, feeling some effect of the bug behind him, which he then watches jump to a panel before permeating it. As Burnham lays it out for Raynor, the power fluctuates and Awoshikun breaks in to tell them she's picking up odd energy and the broadcast of an unauthorized signal. Burnham and Raynor attempt to beam to the bridge but are unsuccessful. An alarm blares and now the ship is moving. Transporters are down and they can't get a response from the bridge. They take the turbo lift and arrive to find Saru and others, including Bryce, Matt, unconscious on the deck in their old uniforms with the ship in a wormhole behind the Red Angel.
Pete, that's because they've gone back to season two. It's going to be one of those adventures. We get the credits. This episode written by Sean Cochran. I don't believe, Pete, any relation to Zephram. Directed by Lee Rose. We are at the end of season two.
The new animation in the credits.
Pete, what new animation is there?
The second piece of the puzzle.
Pete, maybe I shouldn't be mashing that that skip credits button. If they're going to all this trouble here. But back we go to end of season two / beginning of season three. It's when they came to the 32nd century. Ooh, that rhymes as well. Found poetry, Pete. Burnham and Raynor go back to the ready room. They hear Saru prepping the ship to crash land. They're going to end up on a planet, etc., etc. Time skips again, and everything is now stable. Pete, I think we, from the virtue of television, can see things like there's giant access to the open air and they're in San Francisco and things of that sort. It takes our two heroes a bit longer to contextualize that perhaps this is when the ship is being built. Indeed, Mr. Builder is there. Pete, he's listening to his music on his future, you know, iPhone. But they kind of play the role of dignitaries. We're going to do that inspection soon. Maybe not Deck 7. No, Deck 7 now. Prepare for it. Chop, chop.
Yes. And Burnham coming to realize they're in dry dock when Discovery was being built. They're not just going back in time, but jumping through it. This, though, as both of the first two jumps have been to the past. So I wonder if maybe they had changed some of the sequencing because, yeah, you went back one that was behind you. Then you went back further, which was further behind you. Anyway. Raynor asks if it's not temporal but neural, and Burnham points out that Zora didn't register any vessels in the area, and they piece together that the energy fluctuation and their attempt to beam to the bridge is the reason it is not impacting them. And they go again back to the same position when they first tried to transport. This time, more alarms and a battle visible through the viewports. Burnham IDs the stardate as 1051.8, the battle against control. The resetting keeps happening to the same spots, so this rules out a time eddy, and they would have seen that on scans. It must be something with the ship proper. Raynor comes to believe it's a time bug, more specifically a Krenim chronophage known to be sold on the black market, left over from the temporal war and designed to paralyze an enemy ship by randomly cycling it through time. It lasts until the little sucker runs out of juice. Burnham wonders how Maul and Locke would have gotten it on board, but Rayner thinks they got to Trill somehow and crossed paths with one of them. Burnham remembers now Owo saying there was that unauthorized broadcast. Rayner says that would be the location beacon telling Maul and Locke where they are, and hence leading them to whatever clue was in the vicinity of those coordinates. Burnham pointing out that Reese was actually right for this. He was chided by Rayner for guessing. But here Rayner guesses the bug is in engineering. Burnham tries to find a pattern to the time cycle links, but they need to find Stamets, who she explains to Rayner lives outside of time thanks to tardigrade DNA.
Which Rayner does not fully understand in the moment, but it gave me a chuckle to say, the adventures that we've been on, some of which we're reviewing in this episode. Pete, we cut to that same Stamets, who is hurt. He is starting to piece together the particulars here, given that he does live out of time. And as a result of his knowledge, but contrasted by the injury that he has, there he is in sick bay. He's appearing delusional, ranting about, you know, time and engineering and things of that sort. And Colbert gives him a sedative, which on a certain sense, Pete, this is kind of like dramatic playbook 101, but it's also super effective because Stamets is a crazy guy speaking the truth, but everybody around him thinks it's just because, you know, he's got major damage.
Yeah, Zora, who is that? That means nothing to me. Will induce coma. Burnham and Rayner flash again during a cloak alert, but Burnham realizes the last time cycle lasted twice as long as the one before it. They get in the turbo lift headed for storage deck 13, directly via service shaft Epsilon. The long cut, as Rayner refers to it, jives with the temporal prime directive so that they don't influence events. Rayner points out they can't let the computer know they are there either, and Burnham enters her override code, so that'll be the case. But black alert, Matt, Stardate, Osira attack.
And Pete, you know what? You might recall that when, the representative from Variety did the tour of the Toronto stages, all the people said, we save money, we are careful with money. Pete, this episode, so careful with money, we get control, don't see control. Osira is attacking now, no need to see Osira. Pete, this is indeed, though Doug Jones appears via old footage, this is the first episode of Star Trek Discovery that does not have him in the credits, which probably means they didn't even pay old Doug Jones to be in this episode.
So while a bottle episode, and yes, that's true, it is at their normal bigger budget, so it's hard not to slight them on that. You're still getting your bang for your buck, Matt. I mean, two Burnhams and everything that goes into doing that so that it's seamless for a streaming audience.
I bet you that two Burnhams is a whole lot cheaper than the Predator monster from last episode. Because at the end of the day, Sonequa, stand on this side of the line. Stand on that side. You know, nope, costume, hair change. Now stand on that side of the line. Furthermore, her salary is a fixed cost versus more special effects, more money. Look, I'm not down on this episode majorly. I'm just saying I think your bottle episode bottle is showing a bit. But Pete, they're not beyond battling a pair of space biker baddies in biker helmets, which means they're mysterious, I suppose. It's a good fight here. And first our heroes are winning, then they're losing. They're about to be bested. Then Reno saves the day. And Pete, showing the confluence of worlds of imagination here, she's interested in a Vesper martini, ice cold, back at Red's, in a scene that somebody on Twitter swears that Reno will remember, even though we're told that nobody will remember any of these things except for Burnham and Rayner and Stamets.
Right. Rayner posing as Commander Locke on temporary assignment, thanking her here. And again, how he might do that in the lounge later. She tells him to stay away from the bucket heads and even gives him a handkerchief for his face before leaving. Okay, but Burnham and Rayner flash again to a time when Discovery is dusty. Burnham can't get a stardate from the computer. Looks like things don't work well anymore. Que sera, sera is heard, and they go to the bridge where the future's not theirs to see, Matt, because the view screen is closed. What will be, will be?
We have the music stop. Pete was hopeful that we were going to be in the super far-off future. We'll learn shortly that we are several decades in the future.
Calypso?
Yeah. Calypso, I've said it before. Maybe I haven't said it this season, but that Calypso short trek, you know, a top 100 Star Trek story in my book. Now, of course, the amount of Star Trek continues to go up, up, up. But to say, you know, it's in the top, we're probably about 850 episodes at this point, includes the movies as well in that number. You know, to say it's in the top 800 or so, the top 100 or so, I think to me is about right. Again, we're not living in that future right now, though. Zora's memory has been corrupted. Perhaps, Pete, we're hinting towards that future. Zora does a catch me up here. Progenitor tech got into the wrong hands. As for what's out there, the view screen, the physical, you know, bulkhead is opened, and the view screen opens to show a destroyed Federation headquarters. Zora continues to give some exposition here. By the time bug was deactivated, it was indeed the Breen, the threat that Pete has been talking about all season. With the Breen having progenitor tech, it was all over. Burnham considers the dusty old captain's chair and reflects on the first time she was on this bridge. And I have to say, Pete, I'm usually pretty good at, you know, when they're loading up a Chekhov's gun, a story point for later usage, I can usually see it coming. That was not the case in this moment, as she just reflects on her past. Even knowing we were doing time jumps, I think it was a well-hidden anecdote so that Rayner has that information for later in the episode.
Fairly eloquently turned, and I'll talk more about this in theories, Matt, this greatest hits episode, but it took everything in her being to not turn and run boarding Discovery for the first time as a mutineer. She respected Starfleet too much to believe she should be there, but Rayner says she has to be the only person to captain a ship she first boarded as a prisoner. He asks her how she did it, and she tells him she never gave up. Tracking the time cycles, though, it isn't enough. They ask Zora for other variables and key in on the ship's speed. It's not just time, but also their movement in space, which produces a conical wave to track how long they'll have between jumps, with one coming in 10 seconds. Rayner hopes they arrive in an era where Stamets isn't dead. As they prepare to leave, Zora pleads for them to set things right.
The stakes having been reinforced. We cut to Stamets existing at a point earlier in his relationship with Reno, at least, you know, from Reno's perspective, not from Stamets, outside time, blah, blah, blah. He's a bit more friendly than he was at that point. He's also mulling over, you know, a theoretical situation, some temporal unpleasantness. It requires a chronoton thing with dimensional variations. And Pete, it's a bunch of technical time talk here.
You stuck in a time loop again, Paul.
And then she says, just kidding with you, which... Look, I understand that she is adhering to the normal flow of time, so it's not like her knowing would make a huge difference, but that would have been fun. Anytime there's more Reno It certainly is a welcome story. With that, Stamets spots Burnham kind of lurking, and he evacuates engineering, and then ultimately points Burnham and Rayner towards the power distribution system. Look, there's the time bug, but it must be removed carefully. Burnham shares the information about the conical time wave, and Stamets is going to work on a chronoton stabilizer. He needs equipment, so next time let's all meet on Deck 13. With that, Pete, we cut to the meat. Look at that. Efficient yes. storytelling.
The spore breach and the threat there of mushrooms on your lungs, actually a real thing. the spore breach not being a real thing, which he's disappointed later on, they don't know. But he exits the lift on Deck 13, and the next reset is not for another 8 minutes. Good news. Timeline has everything they need to make the stabilizer. Bad news. The main ingredient is field disruptor fluid from 32nd century holodecks. And in this time, Burnham's holodeck would have just been installed. For some reason, Burnham has to explain to a former captain of a 32nd century ship that the captain's quarters is biometrically sealed. So
maybe
she's
explaining to the audience, Pete, although your criticism is logged and aptly noted.
Okay, so she's gonna go and she'll meet them in engineering. Grudge greeting her in her quarters. Burnham pulls the field disruptor fluid from a panel, but not before Book returns from the gym and takes off his shirt. But she's got to be somewhere in 4.5 minutes. And he tells her to trust her instincts, having just become captain.
Indeed, Pete, those words of affirmation there. She can do it. They kiss, they share a loving moment. Back in engineering, though, all is set. Pete, maybe if you looked at the runtime of the episode, I don't know that we're about to solve the problem right now, but that's many an episode. Stamets is going to let Burnham do the honors, but it looks like there's a temporal shield that ages things into non-existence. Let's rock the time jump and meet again. When they do, the solution is to burst the warp bubble, which will give a lot of whiplash. That should let them get to the time bug before the bug can catch up to the change. Break the bubble, turn off the bug, all in the same cycle. That is the new plan. Now, we know where we are, but when are we? This is the Lorca era, but he's away with Saru and Landry. Pete, which is convenient, because none of those three characters appear in this episode in new footage. Game, set, match, story. Star Trek saves money. Thank you very much.
Tantalizing that they're even mentioned, Matt. Lorca, Landry, I mean, what we might have had more of. The bridge is also loaded with familiar faces, including the since-deceased Arium, who Burnham explains to Rayner did not make it to the future with them. Burnham will have to find a way to get them to comply. Stamets will modify the inertial dampers to keep the vibrations from destroying the ship after they break the warp bubble, and Rayner will stick his hand in the spider's nest. Burnham gets in a turbo lift, and Linus enters to tell her red is definitely her color. He exits, and her old self holds the door, attempting to call security, but future Burnham pulls her past self in, and they head to Deck 13, coming clean. Burnham's past self thinks she's a shapeshifter and doesn't think a mutineer would ever end up captain. She really wants to fight herself. So on Deck 13, where no one will see, they throw down, and future Burnham doesn't want to hurt herself, so she nerve pinches her past self, who she tells when she is unconscious to never give up.
This is a solid fight. I would like to point out that one way they make it possible beyond the old, the face of the person you can't see is doing a good job making sure their face does not face camera. There's a number of point of view shots that lets, you know, past Burnham or Captain Burnham, Specialist Burnham or Captain Burnham look directly at the other one being the camera and so forth. And you don't need to do a lot of trickery. You don't even need to do VFX stuff. You just have them look at the camera and chase after it like they're fighting.
They did a whole featurette explaining how they flipped the stunt double and everything like that. Obviously, the costuming and makeup to be able to do that. But clearly, one of the more expensive elements of this particular episode.
We go back to Stamets, who's this time emptying engineering by being surly. He's in a bad mood, so everyone leave. Rayner shows some gruff candor, and Stamets actually needs him to press pause on that. You see, it's a learning moment for Rayner. We all need to work together with that. Let's show them how to do it. Meanwhile, on the bridge, it's a flashback future adventure with Arium ready to boot this interloping Burnham here. You see, Pete, just so you're clear, to have everybody there, first of all, it's the Canadian bridge crew, so they cost a little bit less. Also, they've reused the old uniforms. It's just ready to go here. Burnham shares some personal details with Detmer, with Owo, with Bryce. Again, glad that Bryce is back. Reese and others. Arium, though, is impressed that Burnham is a captain. But we get back to this essential question. Why should everyone trust Captain Burnham? News of Arium's death is shared. And though others are willing to say, no, not Arium, Arium knows that the sacrifice tracks. And with that, Pete, trust has been built.
Yes, 396 days from the current date, she will sacrifice herself, which she admits she would, and then asks Burnham what she needs from them. In engineering, Rayner and Stamets here, Burnham get the bridge to buy in with 3 minutes remaining in this cycle, but past Burnham interrupts with Reese. Burnham can't make it in time to engineering, and Rayner has to handle this one. He does that by connecting with Reese about those 23rd century constitution curves, which he agrees about. Rayner repeats the detail to past Burnham that she told him about wanting to run on her first day on Discovery. He lost his family young too. She ultimately relents. They break the warp bubble and Rayner reaches in and they flash back to the ready room. Rayner with an older right hand. Burnham confirms they're back in the present and only lost 6 hours. She wants him to go see Culber for the hand he's cradling. He credits her for pulling it all off. But she does concede that familiarity can lead to complacency. He knows he can be stubborn like she used to be. And she thinks they made a good team today.
Now, how to tell the crew? They just need to say time bug. We cut to Stamets finding that burned out bug, reflecting on it. Maybe, you know, planting seeds for future episodes. But on the bridge, there's laughter and reflection. Just laughing as friends, as one does on the bridge. And they've found evidence of Maul and Locke's ship. By the way, good job, Mr. Reese. You were right on this one. With that, let's let the mystery continue and start to solve it by ending with happy music. Pete, we have a tactical analysis of this week's threats. Let's continue with our season-long baddies, Maul and Locke.
Interesting use of them just in the prologue to this episode. And the assumption here that they've now moved ahead in the race, having stalled Discovery for those 6 hours. They were caught up in the loop, right? That they put the time bug on Adira, which then causes this. They kill an unsavory cellar in cold blood, but this because they have altruistic aims, Matt, to prevent suffering of other people like them, and to apparently sell the progenitor's tech to some black hats out there.
Potentially to the Breen destroying the Federation, and who knows, whatever, you know, other destabilizing of the Alpha and Beta quadrants. But hey, Pete, they want freedom and love. Another threat in this episode, the Krenim chronophage. And Pete, you reminded me that this is not the first time we've heard of the Krenim.
No, this a villain that popped up on Voyager for the first time and a couple times there. Now identified as of this episode to have been a player in the temporal war.
Yeah, it's a good callback, both to the Krenim as well as the temporal war. I think that, you know, Star Trek is always best when you can use those prior points as just historical knowledge while not being penned in by it. So it was good use there. Similarly, the helmeted Emerald Chain baddies, Pete, one of the benefits of those Emerald Chain helmets is nobody's going to be like, look, that's the stunt guy who last week was, you know, whatever, a fighting Trill. And the week before that, you can't tell, Pete, because they wear motorcycle helmets of the future.
Right. Like, you can literally get out of your vehicle and then not have to go in through makeup and spend a day on the set. You know who else wears helmets, Matt?
Is it the Breen, Pete?
It is. They all look like the character of Boosh from Star Wars.
I guess, Pete, in theories, we'll get your update as to whether the Breen threat was just a setup to get to now or if it's going to continue to evolve. But, Pete, a threat from the past intruding into our future is past Burnham. I welcomed the opportunity, you know, for as much as it's a little like I'm slightly thumbing my nose at the episode saying, I see you're doing a bottle episode where we're just getting the cheap Canadian cast to fill out everybody as we film on the pre-existing sets for 8 days. This was a good reminder of the meager beginnings of Specials Burnham, the change in hair that they had, the change in acting, the change obviously into the old costume. It all worked.
And what Sonequa Martin-Green really does is sell the angst that past Michael Burnham had, the hopelessness, and communicating, albeit to her unconscious self, that, you know, hang in there, stay on the path. You're going to become a captain one day. You're seeing me in this, something that she doesn't retain, obviously, because of the way the story is constructed, but that we know she ultimately finds the grit, the resolve to be able to do that. And when you strip this story of the plot, of the time conceit, it's really one about affirmation, right? That Rainer needs to believe in the way that this crew communicates if he's going to be an effective part of it, that Burnham herself has come a long way, that she sees this in others who need to be able to do it, hence taking him on when it would have been super easy to just say, this guy's a cancer and not part of my future Starfleet. I'm going to throw him away. And instead, she sees the promise and the interest in him in helping Starfleet and the Federation.
It's all stuff that has us look both to the future and to the past. Pete, that's almost perfect setup for our next segment. Pete, as we set our long-range sensors to scan for some theories, what are your thoughts here? We are watching this episode with the future knowledge, future from when it was made, the future knowledge that, you know, after this, there's only 6 episodes to go for the entire series until they do the reboot 30 years from now or whatever. But we can see this episode through the idea of it being the final season. Was this episode written with some of that foreknowledge or that as a strong possibility?
It continues to be pretty apparent to me. They had more than an inkling this was coming. This is a greatest hits episode. Yeah, you can go to like 70s TV and see where like Happy Days might do something like this, but find me something in a recent era of TV where they do this, where they don't know the end is coming. I think they had been given indications, and there's a roundness to it, and it works. I think done in another, just another season of, oh, hey, remember when this happened? It's not as effective. It'd be like, it would have us questioning, well, why are they doing this now?
Yeah, it is kind of curious. Like, we've seen this done better. For example, the Next Generation finale, All Good Things. But this isn't meant to be a finale. Like, we're viewing it through the lens of the sands through the hourglass, and there's only so many episodes left and so forth. But I want to take points off because All Good Things did it better, but that was meant to be the summation of 7 years and all right. of that.
The finale versus a run-of-the-mill episode when, again, they're saying, oh, no, we totally didn't have an idea. You don't write this unless you know that it's coming. It doesn't fit in an earlier season, right? Oh, we'll do this and we'll do a greatest hits episode of halfway through the series. That doesn't track. It doesn't make sense. It's going to bring up more questions in your audience than anything else. Like, why are you doing this now? So to go back and hit all these points, I mean, Matt, randomly cycling, but shall we look at where they randomly wound up in this 6-hour tour?
Sure, please do.
Oh, gee, you know, just randomly first in the day of their arrival in the 32nd century, you know, between seasons following the Red Angel, totally random there. How about the battle against Control, Matt? You know, a season finale, really the episode before that one, totally random they would wind up there. And what about the sweeps episode, if there's such a thing in streaming, where Osiris helmeted baddies took over Discovery? You know, totally random.
I also viewed this episode through the lens of, I think it was in the last week, Alex Kurtzman said, you know, one of the benefits of the lower episode counts, you know, is there are no filler episodes. And my initial reaction before seeing this episode was, yeah, but there's filler and then there's filler. I think I referenced last week the Next Generation episode where Dr. Crusher is in the warp bubble copy of the ship. And, you know, that also has got to be an El Cheapo episode because much of it is, look, there's nobody else. It's just Dr. Crusher on the ship. You know, I really, really like that as a storytelling device, regardless of the fact that it's a money saver and a quote unquote filler. It's not advancing grand themes and all of that.
Can I just address this notion of filler for a moment,
sure,
please? Particularly as someone who aspires to be paid to write for the screen. Anybody who understands what goes into coming up with and executing TV would never ever use the word filler. And I'm going to tell you why. Okay. All of this matters to everyone who is in the writer's room. And the idea that when they break what they do, Matt, as you know, I'm lecturing somebody who knows about this, but perhaps our audience doesn't. Everything they're going to do for a season is planned before they give people the episodes to write. Okay. So here it is. We're going to break the arc of the entire season. And then, Matt, you're going to go write episode 2 in which these things happen. And, oh, everything we've not given you here, you have the freedom within the series Bible and what we do on this show oh, and you're not the showrunner, so you have a little less freedom. But this idea of filler, okay, is utter nonsense. All these stories matter. Do they ultimately all connect in a overarching narrative? We know from the nature of Star Trek, we know from the other TV shows that, you know, depending on the variables within them, whether or not, you know, this is a episodic, Star Trek where things don't carry over, and then there's season long arcs and things like that, which are a much, much more recent idea in TV. But can we please stop with the idea of filler? By that nature, Matt, essentially everything in the original series was quote unquote filler.
Completely agree. And I'm even thinking, to take it outside of Star Trek for a second, I'm thinking of, you know, this show, Discovery, as we've talked about many times before, modeled on Game of Thrones, the success of Game of Thrones and The Walking Dead. One of the best episodes of The Walking Dead, I must confess, Pete, I don't remember which season, maybe circa season 8 or so. You know, there's an episode where the Morgan character, you just spend the entire episode, I don't remember whether it's getting caught up where he's been, but whatever it is, it's like Morgan on an adventure by himself, and it's lovely, and it's not quote-unquote advancing the whatever, advancing the season-long plot. I would also say, in a show that, you know, at its most successful, the season, look, they were never... They were never ever fighting to find the special cure, right, as the end point. It was kind of always the perpetual stakes within a given season. So I agree with you. For Kurtzman to say, oh, we get to avoid the filler episodes, I mean, I'm thinking of the successes of the first two seasons of Strange New Worlds, where, you know, certainly there's some loose interconnection between them, but to sit and go, you know, Kirk and La'an go back to the past and have an adventure. You know, side note, it's an alt Kirk and so on and so forth, but like, it, you know, is that advancing the overall plot of the season or the threat? Like, no,
it does. She carries that forward.
I mean, she does, but it's not clue 3 of 6 that when you put all of them together, you find the tech, you know what I mean? It's not, let's find out what really is going on at the automated starbase. Oh, wait, control has taken over, you know,
like that filler episode where Spock got married or was going to get married and fought his captain. Remember that filler episode? Remember the filler episode with the doomsday machine? Like, stop. These are episodes. These are stories. There is no filler to imply even that, well, it's only a 5-episode season, but we will cram 5 more in there. It's nonsense. It's nonsense. And tell that to the writers.
Yeah, and I think that some of the frustration I feel towards this episode, it goes back to something that we've discussed the entire season. I think we're going to look back at the end of Discovery's run and talk about a bunch of highs and a bunch of great moments and so forth. But there's something in the DNA of this show that is outside the normal shape of what Star Trek can be. And I say can be because, you know, the other major outlier, of course, is Deep Space Nine, arguably the best of all Star Trek shows. And just because that had, you know, some of the best episodes are starring, you know, a recurring guest actor who's dressed as a Ferengi and another one who's a lounge singer, you know, and it works because they understand the characters. Discovery is not a show that spends too much time with the supporting characters. But again, I don't want to sound overly down on this episode. I will say this. I think that we're going to look back fondly to whatever degree we start to see further seeds or tracks of Discovery's final journey in the next 6 episodes. This has been a good look back as well.
The beginning of the episode, the only time we see Maul and Locke, Maul tells the seller that, the type of poison he's been poisoned with, he sold to the Emerald Chain to kill people like her as a refugee, as somebody who was an orphan. Like, I just wish for a little bit more clarity. Women, like, what was that?
I'm going to guess, Pete, that itch that you're feeling is an itch that is on purpose in terms of, I think you're meant to have those questions. We've already had it floated, you know, her connection to Cleveland Booker the Fourth, and she's essentially, you know, family, a sibling of sorts to our book. I think these are questions that we're meant to have. So when it gets addressed next week or the following week, and when we finally reach a point circa episode, I'm going to say episode 8, and she says, "All right, book, brother, let us work together." And, you know, when Burnham and Book, you know, drop her off the academy at the end of the season, pat her on the head, and she says, "Thanks, big brother. Thanks, aunt. Now I shall go on my own, the Star Trek, the Academy series." I think we're going to look back and see that, you know, here there was the plan all along.
Speaking of the plan, Matt, they had the opportunity here. They veered away from it. We still have that Calypso short trek episode. Zora tells the character of Kraft, almost seems like a proto book when you look back at it, that it's been about 1,000 years since the crew abandoned Discovery. That Discovery not upgraded, not bearing the A on the registration or the disconnected nacelles, that they might have gone for it in this time hopping episode, but not yet, if ever.
I may have a couple of thoughts. The strength of that short, as I said before, it's a super strong episode. The flip side is, you know, we've seen in the last, let's say, 3 years of Star Trek production where this team has started to figure out how to wrangle dealing with Star Trek's future in terms of the present day of whenever it is in the timeline that they're telling stories, specifically I refer to the kind of season two conceit of fixed things like, you know, first contact. Those are going to happen in the Star Trek future, but because of time incursions, some things like Khan as an adult in the 90s now is Khan as an adult in the 2030s, so we can see kid Khan, not to be confused with King Kong, you know, in season two of Strange New Worlds. So we're playing less precious with full adherence to the timeline, even when things are said in the Star Trek sense of a firm date being given. Could I see them just ignoring that? I could. Would I appreciate it if at the end of this season they say, and plans are underway to turn Discovery into a museum ship and revert it to its 23rd century design before it goes to the museum, and then we go, aha, you know, but perhaps we will call upon the ship again one day, and you say, aha, that's enough to open our way up to the short. Yeah, I don't know. It's the same.
Is that what they shot at the end?
Is that what they shot at the end? I mean, I feel like I will be okay if the end of episode 5-10 is them wrapping up this issue once and for all. And then, yes, if it's Admiral Vance saying, you know, it's time to move on because of whatever reason, come up with it, because of the battle damage, or they've voted you a new ship, et cetera, et cetera, and we're going to retire this one, but wink, wink, keep it in storage. If ever the call comes again for the mighty Discovery, like, I think those are those things you could shoot in 2 days. Absolutely. I will prefer an end to the show, as in, thus the good ship Discovery now gets to rest. I would prefer that versus, like, I mean, Pete, in my head, I've already started to write the, and maybe this is something I should put on paper for next week's podcast. I already imagine her voiceover at the end, like talking about, and though we will move on, especially that Sonequa Martin-Green, the way she has a wonderful rhythm to her voice, you know, And though we will move on to other trips in our astral voyage, we will all be joined together by this great Star Trek, with which we will boldly go where man and woman and all have never gone before. Like, it's going to happen. I have seen the future, Pete. I exist outside space and time.
Have you seen the past, Matt? How did Linus get stuck in the replicator?
I don't know, but it made me laugh. And again, you know, I'm not trying to pile on this show, but Linus trapped in the replicator, you know, that makes me think of a funny episode. That makes me think of the funniness of Lower Decks. Makes me think a little bit of the lightness that Strange New Worlds can have, where you go, boy, that was crazy this week, where we all got turned into pigs before we finally reversed the pig virus. Like, the kind of off into adventure we go, where consequences happen, but because we're smart and good, we undo those consequences. That's something that's very Lower Decks, that's somewhat Strange New Worlds, and something that's completely absent from the DNA of this show.
It was really nice to get Hannah Cheeseman back to play Arium last scene in the second season when she sacrificed herself. And in such a pivotal role in this episode, again, making me question, like, all right, let's go back. Let's bring this performer we had to say goodbye to way too early, but so important in our coming of age.
I know you keep approaching this episode from the perspective of one last hurrah and starting to say goodbye and so forth, and you could be completely right. I just continue to say, with all due respect to that entire Canadian Bridge crew, some of whom may already have recurring contracts for the season. So, like, you've already built in, we're going to get Detmer and Owo in 5 episodes. That was budgeted forever ago. You know, here's my point, Pete, to stretch and say, Hannah Cheeseman, can we schedule you for a 3 or 4 day shoot on such and such dates? No, those dates don't work. We can move them around a little bit, this and that, the other. To be able to do that is pennies on the dollar. Again, no disrespect to her, being a Canadian-based performer who's showing up in one episode, it's financially so viable to do that. It's financially so viable to say, all these Canadian people who are already not commanding Walking Dead star money, that are not guy who played Mac the Knife in McDonald's commercial and who was in an Oscar-winning Best Picture and et cetera, et cetera. You know, it's a less expensive outing to say, we're going to stay on the ship with our Canadian Bridge crew and maybe pay a little bit more to get Hannah Cheeseman for 4 days.
Rayner tells Burnham that he lost his family young as well. Will we get more about that?
Pete, I think the plan is to have a great Rayner flashback episode in season 6. I mean, will we get that? I guess I would love to get it. I mean, do I think we're going to make the time for it? I don't want to sound so down on this season and so forth, but I don't know that the show is that interested in Rayner doing more than I command one way that's not cool. And by the end of the season, he's like, actually, when we get off shift, everybody, let's go to the holodeck where we can go space surf. I think that they're looking at him in service of the larger story, not him acting kind of as a character completely on his own, if you will. Pete, one more theory, one that ties to something from the beginning of this podcast episode. What are some of the goodies that we were teasing?
Yes, Matt. So a couple here. We mentioned Star Wars before. We mentioned Marvel and what? Not always being able to find things on a streamer because sometimes they go away. Well, with the Blu-ray 4K editions of Moon Knight and Falcon and the Winter Soldier and Andor and Obi-Wan Kenobi all physically coming out on April 30th, we are going to raffle your choice of whichever of the 4 of those you would like. And here's how you're going to enter your name into that running. You must be a patron to do that, or a patron, as we sometimes call them. You need to move up a level to do that. So if you are not currently a member of our Patreon, as soon as you do that, boom, you're in the running. If you are currently, you just need to adjust up. So Matt, for instance, if you are a Patreon for us and you pay $1 a month, at $2, you would be eligible.
Exciting stuff, Pete. And that's not all. Starting next week, for every episode for the second half of Discovery's run here, every patron, regardless of your level, current, regardless of your level in the future, every current patron, we're going to put all your names in a hat. We're going to do a drawing each week, again, 1 week for the next 5 weeks, for a Star Trek Discovery t-shirt. It's going to be fulfilled by Amazon, so hopefully, you know, the old Prime will get it to you fast. If you win, obviously we're going to announce on the podcast. We'll also be in touch to get your sizing info and all of that. And looking forward to getting some Discovery t-shirts out there in the world.
So, yeah, just wanted to be able to give back a little bit to our fantastic patrons.
With that, Pete, let's open Hailing Frequencies.
Hailing Frequencies open, sir.
To Twitter we go, Pete, where we ran a poll. What rank would you give this episode? 3.2% of people gave it an ensign, 6.5% called it lieutenant, 16.1% ranked it as commander, and 74.2% gave it the captain's rank. Some replies here on Twitter. JT Adkins, JTA is me, says, always love me some Star Trek time travel fun. Nice standalone episode that also accelerated some Rayner character moments while also giving us a nice dose of Burnham quiet moments. One development, maybe Maul and Locke aren't just misguided. The let's kiss while the bad guy's dying at our feet thing is kind of the stuff actual bad guys do. Also, will Locke eventually insist that everything happens for a reason? The island is trying to tell us something. I appreciate that reference there. But Pete, let's rewind for a second. Let's discuss his theory. Are they actual baddies that need to pay a baddie price?
I mean, that they're so integral to this season and that we've now laid the redemption path for Maul. You know, do they both get through it? Locke seems the one with greater moral reservations to what they're doing, right? It's almost like they've flipped them. I wouldn't rule out one of them, but then again, we've set Maul up as the one with the greatest potential to be redeemed, and Locke already seems the more sympathetic of the two. So, yeah.
Back to Twitter we go, hearing from Rose Ferry at AnnaRose584. Time travel gives me a headache, but this episode was worth it. Hard to remember Burnham like that, but if it means she realizes she loves Book, then I'll take it. That's also a heads-up reminder there, that it's a little perspective of the good times and some character-building stuff there. Next, we hear from Andre Yeager at Dr. Polo in 1983. They did a great job helping us reminisce about the previous seasons. Really loved the Burnham v. Burnham fight. She did some Emmy-worthy acting in this episode, a perspective that JT Adkins agrees with. Next, Pete, we hear from Spider-Ham Lincoln at TessLC139. A fun and unique take on a time jump sci-fi story. It missed the opportunity to have Pike or Spock cameo as the face of Strange New Worlds, but alas, this is a solid rewatchable episode, but oh no, only 6 episodes remain. More Owo and Detmer, please. Pete, I would reply to that and say, so say we all.
Yes. I mean, it's not the high height of, for my money, the greatest Discovery episode of all time. Also a time repeating episode, that from season one, magic to make the sanest man go mad. But you know, it's kind of that light, right? And you could only do what they did here much later on in the show's run. But definitely evocative of that.
I would agree that Magic to Make the Saints Man Go Mad is, for my money, the best episode of the series. also a standalone. I mean, yes, there's the time travel, but in this show,
you mean filler, Matt?
Well, some might say it's filler. Yeah,
it's not. It's not.
Back to
stories matter. All stories matter.
One more tweet here. Series of tweets from It's Twitter Not Life at KCOILE1. Krenim. It's not that often that you get a callback to a Voyager Delta Quadrant species. Time travel depictions can be tricky, but Trek usually does them well, and this was no exception. Love this episode. Well done bringing back Reese's love of ships, this closing the loop of last week's Get to Know Them little arc. Seeing Arium again was great. All the callbacks to the past were fantastic. New Trek, old Trek, this episode was just Star Trek. One of the biggest surprises was that it wasn't just a tracker that Maul put on Adira, but a Krenim weapon. Just a super well-done episode. I will miss Disco when it's gone, despite my random issues with it. This will go down as one of my favorite episodes. And a reply to that comes from Osir, that's at Vault Osir, and says, the guy that Maul and Locke bought the time bug from was also a Delta Quadrant species known as the Inari. So, yeah, I mean, certainly well steeped here in the lore.
Those Krenim, they were Voyagerks.
Pete, to the email inbox we go, hearing from Dustin, who says, guys, wanted to send a quick hello and say thanks for all you do. Came across your podcast feed when I dove into Picard late last year, and I've since watched fresh or rewatched as many seasons of Trek, Star Wars, and Marvel as I can, enjoying the journey with you guys as episode guides. Truly as a lurker and bandwidth hog, and admittedly a shameless latecomer to the party, that is all the excellent streaming content out there that I only casually watched or completely missed over the last few years. Like you guys, TNG was my Monday night event of the week in the late 80s. I read Marvel Comics in the early 90s and saw midnight showings of the prequel Star Wars movies when kegs of beer were enjoyed in the queue, but then fell off my fandom long enough to now be happily drinking from the firehouse with all the offerings across the properties. I'm the guy listening to the whole season's worth of your podcast 4 years after you recorded them, really enjoying each one. Today, though, is the first time I set my alarm to start an episode before 6 a.m. and caught up with you guys to be able to reach out. Very happy to be able to do so after an episode that both resonated as it did with me and was such a blast to watch. Certainly, it will go down as one of the series' more enjoyable episodes. I say that without my second viewing. And regarding the episode, Pete, Dustin says, this episode of Discovery's hidden in plain sight themes of connection, change both as a challenge and a catalyst, and personal growth as individuals and species really resonate for me personally, and this episode nailed each for me. What an incredible scene to see Michael Burnham literally sparring with herself, both women performing with beautiful subtlety, their respective take on the situation, and wonderfully choreographed mirror fighting was a joy to see. The line in the Sultry Hollow book delivers regarding change, can't recall the exact words as I type, reflects what is part of my personal philosophy, that change is not only hard, but by definition, the only way to achieve progress. The reprisal of Arium wasn't perfect, but it was nice the show gave her another chance to serve. Zora's K. Sarah Sarah scene was well done to raise the stakes, and Raynor definitely nailed the stand down Burnham, trust me, and more importantly, trust yourself moment. Raynor's later cockiness as they debriefed, after all was saved, about how correct he was on his take on leadership and his methods, and his I told you so attitude upon success is mixed well at the end of 504 with just a bit of humility and acknowledgement that there might be multiple ways to lead and connect. Thanks again for all you do. I think you old dogs definitely show us all the time. You know the best tricks. That from Dustin, who notes in a PS, Pete, that he is a patron.
Oh, thank you, Dustin. On top of that, really nice to hear somebody enjoy the backlog. You know, I've heard from people on Patreon, hey, just finished Daredevil after I watched Echo, stuff like that. So, you know, and it's just another way that patrons help other patrons and help other listeners, because all of that is made possible. You know, the amount of, geez, Matt, what's the number in terms of storage that, you know, we have at this point 11 years in?
I mean, some real quick math. I know every month, we don't necessarily get close to our 1 gigabyte cap, but there are definitely plenty of months in the last 10 years where it's been close, or we've done tricks and this and that, the other. So let's just say, for the sake of argument, 1 gigabyte a month times, we'll just say 11 months. just to keep the numbers there. So 11 gigabytes a year. So that's, are we, is that officially a terabyte? I don't know my proper data prefixes, but it's gigabytes and gigabytes and gigabytes, if you will. Pete, what do you have there on Apple Podcasts?
Review Matt left for the Pop Culture Podcast by Fantastic Geek, by Jeff Beeden, headlined Great Podcast, 5 stars. And it reads, I was looking for something that discussed some items a little more in depth. I found behind the scenes insight as well as different thoughts and ideas about the shows I was watching. The dynamic between the hosts is bar none. I enjoy the banter, the discussion, and the appreciation of feedback, and he spelled it, Matt, with the PH, from the fans, also spelled correctly with the PH. A most excellent podcast, party on.
Party on, indeed. And Pete, keeping the party going, let's now hear from Admiral Fred in the Netherlands.
Hello, Matt and Pete, and all listeners to Fantastic Geek. This is Fred from the Netherlands with a little feedback for Star Trek Discovery Season 5, Episode 4. First, I thought this is going to be a very cheap episode with just Rayner and Michael Burnham. But then also Stamets joined the repetition crew. It's a kind of Groundhog Day idea. And the funny thing is that I'm, as you know, watching Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. now, and I just watched the episode, as I have always been, Season 7, Episode 9, which is a terrible time loop episode, and terrible in the good sense. So after having a Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Freddy overlap between Wilfred Malik of Hydra and Fred in Discovery, I now have a Groundhog setting overlap between Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Star Trek Discovery. This is crazy. What can be the cause of this? Who can be behind this? I mean, what is the common factor between Star Trek Discovery, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and me? That must be Fantastic Geek. Okay, now we have cleared that you are behind all this. Now I can give my feedback for Episode 4. A time bug? Really? Oh yeah, I forgot that it's a science fiction and fantasy. Being perhaps one of the biggest Orphan Black fans in Europe, I of course loved the Michael Burnham double role, and particularly how different they were. Great acting by Saniqua Morton Green to portray herself some years ago, meaning that she didn't only go back in Michael Burnham's role, but perhaps even in her own position or something like that. There was a little interview with her in the Ready Room about this episode. That shirtless book could withhold her from being as quick as possible, I can perhaps partly understand, but if you're in such a hurry, I don't know. Lot of convincing here. That was great acting. So Michael with Ariam, nice to see her back, by the way. And Rayner with, let's say, young Michael. Groundhog Day episode of series can be tedious, but I think they did a good job in this one. That was all for now. Greetings. All the best. Fred from the Netherlands.
Pete, I am tickled pink that Fred, seeing everything all connected there. I must confess, Pete, I've lost track. Does Fred watch The Mandalorian? Because, of course, there's some S.H.I.E.L.D. casting crossover there, and I don't just mean Ming-Na Wen.
Yeah, no, he does. We've talked with him before about The Mandalorian. Funny, too, I mean, as what he described as one of the biggest Orphan Black fans in Europe, I mean, I don't think it's just Europe as far as Fred's fame.
Yeah, I mean, I know he's been to, do I remember correctly, he's been to Orphan Black conventions, I want to say, in North America. For some reason, I have Canada in my head. But I would agree. Pete, where's the Orphan Black podcast by Fred? That's what I want out there. The Orphan Black rewatch podcast by Fred.
Or Fred Black.
Yeah, perfect, perfect.
Let's do that. Yeah, but I mean, here's another one, and we don't listen to these beforehand, talking about listening into our backyard, our backlog with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. You know, what used to be the mothership in these here parts that, you know, has since ended a 7-season run, but somebody, again, digging back into it. So, you know, so grateful to be able to provide these for listeners.
Absolutely. Of course, Pete, this entire voyage has been made possible by those who support us on patreon.com/fantasticgeek, and our continued thanks to those who've made it to the end of this episode and can hear us talk about Patreon one more time.
Yes, don't forget to possibly enter yourself into that raffle for your choice of Falcon and the Winter Soldier, Moon Knight, Obi-Wan, or Andor, with the physical release there in the nice steel book, by either joining Patreon for Fantastic Geek for the first time or upping your contribution, all of which is going to wind you up in that hopper.
And Pete, let's keep the Star Trek conversation going. How can people be in touch with you on social media?
You find me on Twitter, on Threads, on Blue Sky, at Peter, P-I-E-T-E-R, J-K-E-T-E-L-A-A-R, K-E-T-E-L-A-A-R, $12,600, can't be wrong.
And while I'm personally on Twitter's Looking Back Lost, do be in touch with the podcast, comment on fantasticgeek.com, check us out on Twitter, Instagram, Gmail, and Threads, where we are Fantastic Geek as well. But wait, Pete, there's more.
Facebook.com/FantasticGeek, all one word with the P and the H, like it today.
As we head into the last weekend of April, looking forward to continue our Star Trek Discovery conversation. Before you know it, Pete, it'll be May. We'll be talking about some Star Wars content, particularly as we count down to the Acolyte series. But for now, I will say adios to all our listeners and give you, Pete, the final word.
Free sounds good.